solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
The acronym is MOVE, which we do for two reasons. One is we're American, and apparently Americans do acronyms. The other is so you can remember it under fire. So M is to be mindfully alert, mindful in terms of noticing, not prejudging, alert like an athlete. O is to be an options generator, to have at least four pathways forward, four ways to win, no matter what the type of challenge. V is to validate your vantage point. So much of business failure is, say, for over-optimism or over-cautious, and how to kind of really see reality for what it is, which gives you a vantage point. And then E is to engage and affect change at scale. So that's MOVE. And each one of those has multiple chapters and deep dives.
Welcome to the 102nd Conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. A series of reflective conversations on leadership, transitions, careers, and life. I wanted to share something with you. Given that we crossed 100 guests, we wanted to pause and reflect on the library that we've accumulated till date. So as a result, we're going to be stopping new guests for a while, and instead we're going to look at themes where we connect the dots across what different guests said on particular themes. A lot of our listeners have told us that what makes this podcast unique is the fact that we cross-reference insights across the various sections of the podcast. Hope you will like that. Needless to say, once we do that for a period of time, possibly a few months, we'll come back to marching forward with new guests. While podcasting accounts for 10 to 20% of my time and effort, my primary vocation is that of an executive coach and a discreet sounding board with CEOs and entrepreneurs. I engage with leaders and organizations with a growth mindset and help them play to their unique potential. You can learn more about the podcast and my work at playtopotential.com. My guests this time are Carol Kaufman and David Noble. Both are world-renowned coaches and have worked with several leaders who've led billion-dollar companies and more. David is also a colleague at Egon Zehnder, a firm I worked with for 6 years before transitioning from the world of poaching to the world of coaching. Carol and David have recently co-authored the book, Real-Time Leadership. Carol describes it beautifully. She talks about the quote from Viktor Frankl. She says, between stimulus and response, there's a space. And in that space is our power to choose a response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. The book, filled with insights, tells us how we can do this. Without further ado, let's dive into the conversation with Carol and David.
Carol and David, thank you so much for making the time on the Play to Potential podcast.
Great to be here, Deepak. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us.
Absolutely. And congratulations on the recently published book, Real-Time Leadership. Maybe just at the outset, if you could give us a sense of why this book. You know, there are thousands of books on leadership. What I find helpful understanding is trying to get a sense of what's the void the authors are trying to fill with the books they write.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll start a little bit. One of the things that really stunned us is that our book sold in about 15 minutes to HBR when we were, in fact, not even trying to sell the book. So I can tell you what they said. What they say about the book is there's a number of things that make it very different and fresh. One is the complementarity of me and David, me coming from a clinical psychology coaching background, David from an operational executive strategist, et cetera. So the book is part leadership book, part business book, and then part really very good stories about leaders, and where we don't make the case for coaching. We just show you kind of, we open up that door for you to look at it. And in that way, it's quite different from other leadership books. The other thing is that Marshall Goldsmith, who's this wacky like coach that everybody knows, who wrote What Got You Here Won't Get You There, he said the book is dense in a good way. And this is a very dense book. It really is kind of like a very schnazzy leadership textbook along with business in there. David, what would you say?
Yeah, I think that, you know, Carol and I, unlike a number of coaches who tend to rely on one or two frameworks, we have an evidence-based approach that spans hundreds of frameworks. And so we really wanted to distill the essence of that in terms of what we found took good leaders to great to extraordinary leaders. So that was kind of the genesis of that. And as Carol said, the book is dense, but we kind of like to think of it as a reference guide. So it's an operating manual that you can actually step into that's very practical to help you move from where you are today to where you want to get to. And I also wrote the book, quite frankly, because from the time I was in my very first job, when I was a speechwriter, I remember writing a speech for the CEO, and this is a while ago, saying we are now in unprecedented times of volatility and uncertainty. And so that has not changed. And I really wanted to write a book that would help leaders step in with more confidence to those crazy types of new types of crisis or opportunity that they face.
Got it. As they say, that speech has aged well.
Yes, exactly.
We went through VUCA, then we went to VUCA squared. Then in COVID, we're like, we thought we were in VUCA before. Are you kidding? Then we've got, you know, war, uprisings, inflation, supply chain. Like, seriously, 20 years ago, people were thinking we're in VUCA. So,
yeah, I think the term I came across recently was BANI, B-A-N-I, brittle, anxious, nonlinear, and I forget the I, but yeah.
Yeah.
Lovely. I think just to quote a statement from your book, you say that in a recent survey by Egon Zehnder of nearly 1,000 CEOs, representing a total of annual revenue of $4 trillion, you say that 90% said that personal transformation was necessary before succeeding in organizational transformation. And you go on to say that in the same survey 3 years earlier, only 30% said personal transformation was key. I was curious, what's changed in 3 years according to you?
I would say
I
that
think it's what Carol was talking about earlier. So, you know, this, bear in mind that this survey was done about two-thirds of the way through COVID. So I think what we found there was that leaders had suddenly realized that their old playbooks just completely fell apart, that it wasn't helpful in dealing with a new type of crisis. It wasn't helpful in helping them transition from, you know, being decision makers to being comforters, to caring greatly about their people, to inspiring them, to giving them hope. And it was presenting a challenge for them as individuals just in terms of their own resiliency. And then when you pile on all the other factors that Carol has noted that came subsequently, it's like you have to transform in order just to stay in the game.
Totally.
Got it.
And also, like, all of a sudden, you're seeing into people's lives in such a different way. So there you are. I mean, in what EXCO team meeting in the past has someone's child come in and crawled on someone's lap, you know? Or I was working with one, like, actually, quite frankly, very scary guy who, like, was chair and founder and owner of a multi-billion-dollar company. And there he is talking very seriously. And the next thing you know, there's some like little kid on his face, you know, crawling all over him. And you suddenly see such a different side. So I think a lot of when the world is unsafe, I think people become exaggerated versions of themselves and they have exaggerated needs. And for some, there's the exaggerated need and understandable need for a comforting figure. And then for others, I think it's one possibly one of the reasons everybody's been drawn to going to the right so much, is someone who really makes life simple and gives you an answer, etc. And I think that a lot of it, I think there's a real, you know, pull and polarization in what people are looking for and then how leaders can respond.
Hmm. And diving into the meat of the book, you organize the book around the MOVE framework, M-O-V-E, which is the underlying architecture of the book. At the outset, mm-hmm. for the purpose of the listeners, could you sort of paint a picture of what this is? And then we'll of course, get into some of the specifics.
Okay, so the acronym is M-O-V-E, which we do for two reasons. One is we're American, and apparently Americans do acronyms. The other is so you can remember it under fire. And I'll just lightly touch on each one. And then if you want, David and I can share a double or triple click on any of them. But the overriding principle first, backing up, is an overarching theme, and it comes from a quote from Viktor Frankl, which is between every stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space, you find your freedom of choice. And real-time leadership is about helping leaders make that space. Then once they've made it, to have choices of what to do in that space. And we, in our frameworks, the MOVE gives people a lot of ideas on how to move forward, and also can be used very quickly. So M is to be mindfully alert, mindful in terms of noticing, not prejudging, alert like an athlete. O is to be an options generator, to have at least four pathways forward, four ways to win, no matter what the type of challenge. And David and I published an article in Harvard Business Review in the January-February edition, which was called The Power of Options. V is to validate your vantage point. So much of business failure is, say, for over-optimism or over-cautious, and how to kind of really see reality for what it is, which gives you a vantage point. And then E is to engage and affect change at scale. So that's M-O-V-E. And each one of those has multiple chapters and deep dives and stories in the book.
Got it. David, anything you would like to add?
No, I think that's a good high-level flyover. If you think about it, M is what you want or need to get done. O for the options is how you get it done. V is a vantage point check on reality to make sure you're seeing reality for what it is. And then E is how you take all those things, what you want to get done, how you might approach it, your reality check, and then you scale it up as a leader so that you can work through others to achieve more things together.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman. I love the reference to Viktor Frankl, where he speaks about seeing the space between stimulus and response as an opportunity. This reminds me of something that came up in my conversation with Rich Fernandez, who's the CEO of Search Inside Yourself, a leadership development company incubated in Google. He speaks about the difference between reacting and responding, and talks to the notion of response flexibility.
To exercise that response flexibility, right? When you're aware of your emotions, you're able to manage them. When you're aware of your emotions, you're able to respond rather than react. Now, some listeners might say, well, look, Rich, it's really important to react. I'm in a business where I have to react. And I would say to you, unless you're experiencing an existential threat, like your life is in jeopardy, it's going to always be far more effective to respond rather than react. Because responding doesn't mean going slow.
True.
So let me give you an example to make this really concrete and really, really clear. Have you ever been in an airplane and experienced heavy turbulence?
Absolutely.
You have, right? I'm sure the listeners have too, right? Who do you want in the cockpit in that moment? Somebody who's reacting and just alarmed and on fire, or someone who's calm, competent, clear-headed, and knows exactly what needs to happen and when it needs to happen.
Hmm. You want Captain Sully.
Yes, you want Captain Sully Sullenberg. I've actually met the man. He came to give a talk at Google, and he is that way when you meet him. He is like one of the calmest, most grounded people I know. But what does he say, actually? He says that he trained, and this is, by the way, for the listeners who aren't familiar with Captain Sully Sullenberger, he's the man who landed the jet plane that was flying over New York City. It flew through a flock of geese, so they lost all jet propulsion because the geese flew into the engine and burnt them out. So in the space, I think, of about 3 minutes, he had to make a split-second decision to land the airplane on the Hudson River. It was the only available large open space over New York City. But he thought about this very, very calmly.
Bringing it back to David and Carol's work, I guess the key opportunity is for us to pause, slow down the tape, and to create the space for us to exercise the MOVE in that space. Thank you for listening. If you want to tune into the conversation with Rich Fernandez, you can just go to playtopotential.com and find him in the guests section. That's PlayTopotential.com. Let's now get back to the chat with Carol and David.
Let's start with M, mindful alertness. One of the things I really liked in the way you sort of describe it is you say that leadership is a three-dimensional challenge, and you sort of lay out the three different dimensions around which we need to be mindfully alert. So could you sort of expand on that for the listeners?
Sure. So I think all of us are exposed to one or two dimensional leaders. So they are the people who are incredibly results oriented and hit every target, but that comes at the expense of their people. We all know people who are wonderful servant leaders who care deeply about unlocking others' potential, but they find it hard to establish boundaries to hold other people accountable. And then we also know these great individual contributors or subject matter experts who are, you know, individually brilliant, but they actually can't relate to other humans. So those are all one-dimensional leaders, and they all fail in terms of being extraordinary. So we think that to literally be a whole person, a whole leader, someone who has the potential to be extraordinary, you need to be three-dimensional. So the first dimension is the external dimension, which is what is it that you want or need to accomplish? And that could be a financial target to hit. It could be a decision to make. It could be a merger to complete. It could be a culture to implement. But it's like, what is it that you're focused on doing? What do you want to accomplish? The second dimension is the inner dimension, which is, okay, we're clear on our goals, but who do you want to be as a human, as a person, while you're doing this? So do you want to be a leader who is patient, a listener, who has perspective, who's fair, who's inclusive? Like, what are the kind of character strengths and traits that you want to cultivate and project as a leader? And then the third dimension is, you know, once you're clear on what you want to get done and who you want to be, the third dimension is how can you best relate to other people so that you can achieve goals through them and achieve goals together. So for us, it's everyone knows the golden rule, which is I will treat you the way I want to be treated. And I can tell you in my own case, that works for a very small subset of the population because I like to get the news direct and not everybody does. So for us, it's more the platinum rule, which is we want to relate to people in a way that they want and need to be related to so that they can receive what we have to say and we can work together. So that's kind of the three dimensions. And Carol's got some examples if that's helpful too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure.
So the first one is, first of all, it can seem obvious what you are supposed to do. Like, you know, you go in, two examples is one is you walk into a team meeting, you're got to make a big decision. And so clearly your goal in the meeting is to make a decision. Well, what if that's not correct? And the actual goal is to create psychological safety so the team can have a good conversation, or, you know, to create a divergent thinking, et cetera. So one of the, like, sort of in terms of the quick tip, It's like you walk into the room, see a bunch of people at the table, you're about to launch in, quickly ask yourself, what do I actually need to do? What's the most important thing? Like, am I right? That's okay. So what do I need to do? Then who do I want to be? And we sort of shorten that up to who do I want to be right now? And, you know, and the bigger identity of who do I want to be, we actually have a number of like starter questions in the book for that. But it's who do I want to be right now? And one example is talked about that with one of our CEOs who we suggested. And by the way, every single person, including you, I'd like to challenge you to do this, like today, tomorrow. Ask yourself, who do I want to be right now at every meeting and then at every moment when you're annoyed? So you're at a store, there's the cashier in front of you who is talking and talking to someone about their vacation and you're in a hurry. Okay, and just as about, you know, you want to say like, excuse me, or explode, or just feel really frustrated, just say, who do I want to be right now? Now, the answer isn't, I need to be a nice person, but for you to have that choice of who do I want to be right now? And this one woman, CEO of a major tech company, asked herself that before every meeting. This was during COVID, the 16th meeting of the day. She's like, I just want to go home. And, you know, going to the next meeting, she asked herself, who do I want to be right now? And that opened up the way for her to think, wait a minute, the most, like the least important meeting of my day or of my week is the most important meeting of theirs. And then she then opened up and a different her showed up. Like, who do I want to be? Do I want to be that bored person who phones it in and everybody can tell? Because leadership is often what you emanate more than you say. So that's that one. And then I think the, you know, how do you want to relate? I think David's example of the platinum rule is really just perfect. But the whole point is to make space for choice, for conscious choice.
And in your experience working with leaders, you know, in terms of, you know, sort of the knowing doing gap, is do they, you know, of the three, is there one or two where they find it harder in terms of practicing it and bringing it to life?
So one of the things that we urge people to do, because there's so much content in the book and in the MOVE model, is that you don't have to apply the whole thing in sequence. Depending on what you're facing, one part of the model could actually unlock you. So for example, if you did a quick scan of like, what's going on with me right now in a major leadership challenge that I'm facing, you could just ask yourself, am I really clear on those three dimensions? Do I really know what the goals are? And if you are, that's great. If you're not, that's a great place to get started, because actually naming in as consciously and as fully as you can what your goals are is actually really helpful in order to set up the achievement of those goals and to make every moment count as a leader, because that's what our book is all about, making every moment count. And that's sometimes depending on your reflexes, but often it's transcending your reflexes so that you can face something new or something good or something dangerous. So the other thing is, sometimes we're stuck in the way forward. So if you're stuck, then you go to the options generator to figure out practical ways to find four or more ways to win. Another thing that's really good, particularly if you're in new situations, like a big new job, for example, or just a new environment with new people, is to really check your vantage point and make sure, like, am I seeing reality for what it is? Or am I kind of discounting or exaggerating threats or opportunities? Or am I even just missing the point? And then the last thing is, if you're kind of stuck in achieving alignment on your direction with your team or with your organization, then you go into E and sort of focus on engage and affect change. So there's different ways that you can kind of unlock, and everybody's got a different situation.
This is your host, Deepak, again. I love the point David makes about the distinction between the golden rule and the platinum rule. We need to tune into what will move the people around us. treat others like the way we want to be treated is arguably flawed because people around us are not like us. I also like the insight they have around the fact that we have a choice around who we want to be in crucial moments. Very often we think about the solution space in the to-do plane, but very often we miss out on the opportunities in the to-be plane. I'm reminded of an insight from Rajiv Vij, author of Inside Out Leadership. He talks about the notion of how we can be deliberate about a to-be list instead of a to-do list.
So one of the things I tell people is, you know, walk into the office, sometimes throw your things to do list and replace it with a things to be list. You decide the kind of person, the kind of leader you want to be, and try it for a week or two. And every day say, what kind of a person or a leader I want to be, and try being that way. And you'll be surprised how the doing will take care of itself. So for example, if you were to tell yourself, you know what, I'm going to be just more mindful as a leader, or I'm going to be more courageous, or I'm going to be more empowering, I'm going to be more strategic, or even in our personal life, I'm going to be more loving to my family, right? Rather than saying, I want to spend more time with my children, because you may spend more time, but if you are getting upset with them every 20 minutes, I don't know how good that quality of time was. You know, if you say, I'm going to be more loving and more encouraging, more reassuring, or whatever is your need, that then you spend even 10 minutes instead of that 45 minutes, but they were loving moments. They'll be better spent than simply just, you know, the doing part.
I find that ticking off the to-do list leads to P&L outcomes, while working on the to-be list drives balance sheet outcomes. Let me share a personal anecdote in this context. It's not quite a high-stakes leadership situation, but still a moment where I felt taking a pause made all the difference. I was at a toy shop looking to buy a gift for a birthday party that my son was going to attend. My son and I were the only customers in the shop, and in the shop were a father-daughter combination. The father was somebody who didn't go to school. He was busy playing Candy Crush, and the business was the only thing he knew. And the daughter was engaging with me and my son, helping us pick the right gift. As we were going through the various options, suddenly she paused and hesitatingly asked me. She said, "Sir, can I ask you a question?" I was a little surprised, but I said, "Go on." She went on to speak about the fact that she was a graduate in commerce and she was evaluating an MBA program, which was structured as 1 year in India and 1 year in the US. And she just wanted to know if it made sense to do it. My instinct was to quickly brush this aside, to say, sorry, I don't have a clue, and move on with my agenda, which was to pick a gift. I don't know what came upon me, I just paused and asked myself the question, who do I want to be in this moment? If my mission is to help people play to their potential, am I showing up in line with my mission in this moment? I think that brief pause got me to reflect and say, while I may not be the right person to guide her, I might know a couple of people who could guide her. So I shared their email IDs with this girl and spoke to her as she was gift-wrapping our present to share a few additional perspectives. This is work in progress for me, and I'm sure there are many moments where I miss taking a pause. But I just realized that pausing and asking, who do I want to be in this moment, to be really powerful. I'm trying to do this more and more as I move forward with my life. If you're deriving value from the podcast, do take a moment and rate and review on Apple or Spotify. It will really help us attract better speakers and help audiences find their work amidst thousands of podcasts out there. Now, let's get back to Carol and David as we walk through the rest of the MOVE framework.
And moving from M to O, I like the phrase you use, where there's a will, there are at least four ways. And you go on to talk about the four different stances we could take in the way we engage with the situation. Could you talk a little bit about the four stances, lean in, lean back, don't lean at all, and lean with? And more specifically, as I was sort of processing it, I was sort of trying to get the nuance between lean back and don't lean at all. But would love to hear you sort of unpack that.
So let me just set that up, and then Carol can talk about the four stances, because those are that's one way of finding four ways to win. And there's also many other ways to find four ways to win in the book. It's a really crucial thing. But the premise is that because volatility is on an escalating trajectory, we get nonlinear kind of curveballs and obstacles thrown at us all the time. So what we find is that good leaders can identify one way to win. But in many cases these days, you need a backup to that plan and you need a backup to the backup. So that's why we want to have way power, which is multiple ways forward, because the more viable options you have to achieve a goal, again, the more likely you are to achieve the goal. And then Carol can pick it up for the stances.
Right. And there's a lot of research based on this. Many, many studies have looked at it and looked at predicting success based on, do people have this way power? Where does this come from? It comes from the four main reflexes that we all have, which are fight, flight, freeze, and befriend. Befriend is a new one in terms of people understanding it. And that is, you know, if you see a little kid in front of a bus coming on, you don't think whether or not you should save them. You just, it's a reflex to just grab them. We've translated this into what we call the four stances. So mm-hmm. if you watch tennis, for example, or even play it, it's not what they do with the arms. It's how they set their legs, the stance they take before. It's a forehand, a different stance for a backhand or close to the net, etc. And that's basically what we think is, what is sort of your default stance that you can take? And then how can you expand it? And the four stances are, in a nutshell, first, you know, lean in, lean back, don't lean, or lean with. So lean in is rolling up your sleeves, really engaging. If there's a conflict, going there. Now, it doesn't mean you lean in a directive way. It means you're actively engaged. It could be edgy. It could be enthusiastic with a lot of zest. It could be with the delicacy of a ballerina or the intensity of a rugby player. So there's many ways, and in the book, we actually have a host of examples and directions that you can take. So that's lean in. Lean back is basically data-driven, inquiry-driven. I'm going to take a lean back. I'm going to look at the topography. I'm going to look at the data. I'm going to be very rational in what I'm thinking and in my choices. If I have to do a reduction in force, I'm not going to be leaping in and doing that. I'm going to really get out my spreadsheets and figure out what's right. Leaning with is leading with caring, concern, nurturance. And if it's at scale, it's culture. If you have a merger and acquisition, you know, your integration, you're going to kind of be thinking people first. So lean in is action first. Lean back is, you know, data first. Lean with is people first. And don't lean at all is reflection first. And the capacity to not lean, which is the toughest of all, requires a decision to be able to tolerate doing nothing for, it could be seconds, it could be moments, it could be a decision. And that would be, so why does that one matter? One reason it matters is the other three are all kind of what your brain is producing. This one is making a reflective space so an idea can like hit you. It kind of opens you up to kind of intuition or kind of new thoughts. One way, simple example is, let's say, okay, so Deepak, you're giving a talk and it's kind of important to you. And maybe it's even being filmed. And then somebody in the audience sneers at you and really has that like, this is so stupid. I can't believe we're wasting our time. Okay. So you can imagine the different stances. You would respond rather differently. So if you're going to lean in, you might say, excuse me, what's going on? Or like, okay, I'm not going to look like a bully in front of everyone, but I'm going to talk to this person after the meeting. Okay. Leaning back. It may be like, okay, what's the data? What might the person be responding to? What are they thinking? What is the best way for me to like interact in this moment? Like, I'm just going to go with the data. Now, leaning with, I'm like, oh no, what did I do? Like, you know, like this person, I've offended them. And I might like then the whole rest of the talk be like honing in on them and making them like what I'm doing. But don't lean is I'm just not triggered. This person has sneered and it's nearly a non-event for me. I will just go on. I'm reflecting and I don't have to react. So those are the four stances and one way you can think about them.
I think that the not leaning is the most difficult one, as Carol said. And that's something because as leaders, we're all very action oriented. But when you think about it, it can manifest not just in allowing your intuition to come to the surface or to take a moment to calm yourself, but also sometimes you can just wait and hopefully your team is going to fill that void. You don't always have to act on everything. And, you know, that team should be filling that space in many cases too, rather than you leaning in. And then also, you know, the example of letting the sneer go. Sometimes when there's something, you don't actually have to confront it. You don't have to deal with it. You can just turn aside and let it go right past you. So it's actually a very powerful stance that's quite underused in the repertoire of post leaders.
And you also go on to say that we all need to pick an approach that's consistent with our core self. Can you expand on that in the sense that the stance we take needs to be resonant with who we are? I found that quite intriguing. A part of me was wondering as I was reading that to say, I guess the corollary to that also means that we also need to learn to flex to go beyond our default response. But I was curious to get your sense on that connection.
Well, let me kind of step into that, because I think if you look at the sequence, we first want you to understand what your default response would be. Because again, the whole theme of the book is know when your default is not going to serve you well. So we want you to know, like if you're a lean-in person, to know that that tends to be overused. Then, of course, we want and need you to be genuine as you step into the other stances. So what we do is equip you to be more agile across all those other stances. So we actually show you how to step in more. So if you're a person who finds it difficult to lean with, to connect with people, we show you how to do that. Or if you find it difficult to lean in, we show you how to do that. So all the way through, you are being authentic, or you're growing as a person so that you can be more agile.
Yeah, and the important part is...
Sorry, please.
Just remember that the whole point is for a leader to find that space between stimulus and response. And this is one of the key things in that space. And because we've made it so simple, you know, who do I want to be? You know, what do I want to do? How do I want to read to late? Do I want to lean in, back, with, not lean? We're making it so it can be sort of super quick, laser questions to ask yourself and possible micro behaviors. So on one hand, it's very important to know what your default is and to use your default when that's appropriate, but also to tweak your default. So one of the things we do in the book is we have three chapters based on the options generator. The first one is just about, it's more business, it's more of a business chapter. And it goes beyond that to how you can make more options, more business decisions. Then the second one is how do you use that material in terms of your own development? How quickly or intensely do you take it on, et cetera? The third one is how do you lean in, back, or whatever? And it actually has a series of sections on each one to talk about. You can lean in. Well, how can you lean in with your strengths? How can you lean in with your values? How can you lean, you know, so there's lots and lots of nuance. You can sort of do a totally deep dive. And at the same time, you could do it in seconds.
Got it. And one of the examples that struck me, which got me curious, David and Carol, you say that female Olympic athletes with high willpower and way power did much better than most of their contemporaries. I used to train for half marathons a few years back, it was interesting to see this applied even in an endurance sport where you would think it's all about sort of the physicality and the willpower. But I'm curious how way power finds this application in that context.
Yeah, so there's a number of questions that there's a very simple questionnaire on WayPower. And basically people who said things like, you know, when something goes wrong, I have a backup plan, you know, or I have two backup plans. Or if I'm approaching something, I can think of four different ways to do it. And what it is it's almost like that person will be more resilient and agile. And also it's like they're not assuming that the first thing they do is going to be successful. I mean, think of entrepreneurs. I mean, think of, you know, like Edison and the light bulb. What was it? The 5,000th try did it? So that's what it is. But these studies go from studies with toddlers to grandparents, to athletes, to CEOs. These findings are very, very robust. And people can Google an article called Rainbows of the Mind, and that will have a lot of references.
There's a very practical example which might bring it home, which is imagine that you are on one side of a chasm and there's a 2,000-foot drop or 1,000-meter drop between you and the other side, and the other side is actually not that far away. Now, if you only have one way to get across there, you're probably going to be very reluctant to cross that chasm. So the things that might help you are if you look for options that are based on strengths or assets that you can resource. So for example, you might be a good runner. So that might help you get some speed up and some lift. You might be a good jumper. That's great. You might be able to see assets on your side of the chasm that could build a bridge to the other side of the chasm. Or you might be able to connect with people across that chasm who can help you get across it. So that's like four different ways to win to actually get across. So you're much more likely to attempt it, much more likely to succeed.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. I love the way Carol and David expand on the point around expanding the choice set when it seems like there's only one option in front of us. Something similar came up in my conversation with Sir Andrew Lickyman of London Business School, who's researched the theme of leadership judgment for a long time.
Well, very often leaders are faced with choices presented to them, which are, you can do this or this. Sometimes it's, you can do this or this or this, and the indication is, well, the middle one is actually the one which we're steering you towards. Sometimes they only are given one option. Now, in all these cases, I think somebody who's running an organization has got to ask the question, have I been given all the options? And in particular, you know, for example, do I understand how risk plays out in these options? So simply being presented, what I meant by not being boxed in is, if you are presented with two options, and you feel there are more options, then you should be asking for more options, not just simply accepting there are only two options because that's what has been presented to you. Sometimes it may be that you say, we're not going to take any of these options because we haven't got certain important facts and we need to think again, go away and look at it again. So there's another option, which is do nothing at this stage. Now, I'm not suggesting, by the way, that there should always be delay, because in some cases, delay is disastrous. And there may be, in that sense, you may be boxed in because you can see that if you wait for another 10 minutes or a day or a week, then matters will be outside your control. You will have taken a bad decision by taking no decision. But what I meant, therefore, is that leaders ought to make sure that when options come to them, they are careful that these are not the only options available.
Let me share a very personal example here. I remember driving up to a restaurant by one of the highways near Delhi. It was a hot day and it was around 4 in the afternoon, and I was looking for a cup of coffee. It was that time in the afternoon. I remember going up to the counter and asking the person for a cup of coffee. The person asked me which size I would like, medium or large. Clearly, it was a crowded coffee shop, and I was in a rush to place the order and move forward. I was about to blurt out my preference, but I hesitated and did a double take and asked them if they had a small, to which the person gave me a sheepish smile and said yes. This is such a frivolous example of choosing from what is presented to you. But to Andrew's and Carol and David's point, given the stakes are high, pausing to generate multiple pathways to a situation can be really powerful. Very often we talk about willpower. I think we need to pay as much attention to waypower. Are we generating multiple ways to solve a problem? Let's get back to Carol and David now.
Let's move to the V, the vantage point. You know, in the podcast some time back, I had an opportunity to speak with Amy Edmondson of Harvard Business School.
And we love Amy.
In that conversation, she used the term naive realism, which sort of said a bias that leaders fall into, which is to say that what I see is all there is. And when I read the V, it felt like a very concrete way of overcoming the bias. Am I reading this right, or is this a different interpretation of?
No, it's absolutely, you're totally reading it right. And I forgot about that. So I'm very happy to be reminded. To validate your vantage point, the first question is, how do I assess if I have a good vantage point? As a leader, how do I assess if one of my reports has a good vantage point? So what is the cure for naive realism? And we think first of four ways to describe what a 10 out of 10 in a good vantage point is. And then we have another section on what is it that can distort your view and how to kind of be grading yourself on both of these. The positive one is, you know, is your vantage point, and I'll describe each one, is it clear? Is it at the right kind of resolution or definition? Is it broad enough or narrow enough, or is your altitude right? And it would be, you know, clear. Okay, am I looking at the world with pink rose-colored glasses and I'm thinking everything's going to work out? Of course I'm right. And, or are you working at with charcoal-colored glasses and nothing's going to work right and you're not going to be happy at this? And, you know, so the emotional tone. Then are you nearsighted? So you're maybe great with tactical things, but not good with strategic. Or you're farsighted. You're really great. You know, here you are at the top of the skyscraper of your career, but people are like little ants and you've lost track with your frontline people. So these are things to be thinking about, you know, rose-colored glasses, charcoal glasses, you know, and are you nearsighted, farsighted? And sometimes with one leader, you will basically, one person's like nearsighted and farsighted, but nothing in between. So that's clear. The next one is basically resolution. Do you need a high definition view? You know, do you need that, you know, 5K super high clear? But we all have an attention budget. So you can blow your wad too early if you're that level of attention with everything. So how do you make the choice of what do I really focus on clearly, and where is it okay to have an impressionistic view? So that's resolution. Then I think breadth and depth are a little more obvious, which is, you know, to do what I'm doing, can I look at the entire horizon? Is that ideal? Or do I want to narrow in? If it's creative brainstorming, you want a wide view, peripheral view, because two dots may suddenly, you can see them at the same time. But if you're doing a budget, you better not be doing blue sky thinking. And the same with altitude. There's Rosabeth Cantor's work on zoom in, zoom out. Do you want to be a hawk or a hummingbird in this situation? So those are the four things to look at, like for ideal vantage point. But then what can distort your vantage point? And we need to be very much aware of that. Some things are conscious, some are unconscious. Some of us, we all have biases, you know, familiarity bias, attribution bias, but we also have cognitive styles that aren't necessarily, you know, content biases, but there's just ways we think. And then, of course, there's, you know, unconscious bias and things that we don't even know that we don't know. and blind spots. And in the book, we go in detail on all of these, including the I don't know what I don't know, sort of the Rumsfeld thing, or the one that's really interesting for coaches is what is it that I don't know that I actually know, and how a good coaching questions or self-reflections can sort of go, oh, that's what I think. So that's V. That's got your vantage. And as David says, whoever sees things first has an, pardon the pun, advantage.
Got it. Just building on the vantage point insight, I guess it's all the more pronounced when transitions happen, right? When a new CEO takes charge, then discerning what's the right vantage point is that much harder because you're also trying to make sense of the topography, the characters, sort of the political magnetic forces at play. So do you want to sort of expand on how to think about vantage point, especially in the context of a leader that's transitioning into a new role?
Sure. I mean, for us, that's so when you look at the model of move, again, it doesn't have to be sequential. So the thing that really pops for us, if you're in a big new job, whether you're the CEO or not, is the vantage point, because literally, whether you're being promoted into that role or you're coming in from outside the organization, all these relationships are new in some way. Even if you're within role, you're looking at things from a different perspective. So your old peers are now your direct reports. And that's a very challenging situation. So we actually encourage leaders coming into a role to look at all the people that are involved in that role from a 360-degree perspective. So it's to really understand, like, what is the agenda? What's needed of me? What kind of relationship do I want to have with my new boss? Even if I'm the CEO, I've got a board to deal with other stakeholders that are around me, like regulators or analysts or whatever, with my team, and then across my organization. So it's actually trying to read what's actually happening there in terms of other people interpersonally, and then how I want to kind of meet that challenge. And there's other things around vantage point that also come into play when you've got a new role. So, for example, there's mandates that are sometimes illusions or not illusions. So you come into a job and you're the new leader in a group, and it's like, yes, you have a mandate to transform the group. And the moment that you do that, you meet resistance from the very people who gave you that mandate. So, you know, there's no amount of due diligence that you can do to actually make sure that that doesn't happen. But how can you explore that in front? So, for example, if you're contemplating going into a new job and you understand what you think the scope of magnitude of the challenge is, if you say, like, well, okay, and what happens if we need to take the group in this kind of organization? And if you hear, oh, yeah, that's okay. Okay, let's keep pushing on that a little bit further. Well, what if that means a massive investment? What if that means a massive transformation? What if that means a new type of acquisition? What if it means a product extension? So you get more and more specific, and if the answer is yes all the way through, it's like, okay, that's not a red flag. But often when you ask those kind of questions, it makes it more real to the person that you're talking to. And they'll say things like, it would depend under the circumstances. So that's a red flag. And that's something to really push on to make sure that you actually, your perception of the mandate is as close to reality as possible. The other thing is just one other thing, which really pops for us for people who get into new jobs, is there's this tendency to want to do too much too quickly. So if you don't read the organization's capacity that you've got, you can kind of make people tip over, and that can make you not succeed. So it's like having enough self-awareness and self-regulation to calibrate how hard you're pushing the organization and to be able to read them as well. So all those things are vantage points, and then being able to step into other people's perspectives as much as you can step into your own perspective, which is part of diversity and inclusion. All those are important dimensions in a new role too.
Got it. And
yeah, we have a whole chapter We have a whole chapter on that, by the way, of stepping into. We have two chapters on that. And it's interesting you picked up on that, because the first half of the two chapters is just on the vantage point of a new CEO, a new leader. And then the others are the mindful alertness, the options generator, and engaging in effect change of that leader. So that's great.
This is Deepak here again. I'm reminded of an insight from R. Gopalakrishnan, who studied fault lines in a leadership transition and has authored the book Crash, which profiles 15 high-profile hires who couldn't quite land and, despite a lot of fanfare, ended up as a failure. He speaks about the criticality of discerning the pecking order of stakeholders.
So one of the things I learned, I'm not sure where I learned it, how I learned it, but I'm sure I learned it from somewhere or the other, some experience, is if you want to change things in the organization or which you're going to lead or be a leader of, first you have to change yourself. The so-called objective metrics are actually subjective, in the sense they focus on increased profits by 20%, diversify into X or Y, which are all fine, but those depend on the context. So we set targets for various companies in February for the year 2021. Who the hell knew COVID was coming? So the context has changed, and therefore the performance metrics automatically change. Coming to the other part, the invisible part, boards are not interested only in your achieving objectives. They are interested in how you achieve the objectives. It is stylish to say, just deliver me the results, I don't care how you do it. But in reality, we are interested in how they did it also. If a CEO is slitting a few necks every night to achieve his results, then you have to accept that there's a criminal case building up. So that's what I mean by the soft part. There are multiple stakeholders. You know, you have so far grown in your career thinking, I have one boss, if I satisfy him, everything is all right. Your board itself has a chairman, and directors have been around 20 years, directors have been around 2 years. And then you have your leadership team, your subordinates, if I may use that word. Then you have your stakeholders, your shareholders. You have your allies, you know, suppliers, vendors, bankers. And depending on the way you act and behave, a pecking order emerges. If you're a very strong domain person, say you've been in the auto industry for 30 years, you joined an auto company, then you pick up the phone and start energizing your old network. You know, of some fellow who supplies very good components. That might be misinterpreted in your new environment. You are doing that because you are head of purchase in some other auto company. You don't sort of bring in all your old buddies. But I mean, very strong in recruiting talent, and then you go and fill up the place with the people from your own company, or perceived to have done so, even whether you have actually done so or not. And people don't like that. So I use the word pecking order of stakeholders to mean what was your strength until the other day can play out to be your weakness. So while you must have a 360 degree approach to all your stakeholders, without doubt, the angles of the pie keep changing depending on who's the person who's there. I have known situations where, you know, people say that, you know, he came from so and so place, he's filled it up with people from that place. It's not at all uncommon in CEO transitions.
I like what Gopal says. Even what seems like an objective metric is often subjective to context. Being able to read the room and discern the various vantage points can be a big advantage as you settle into a new company. Let's get back to Carol and David now.
Yeah, just sort of to sort of go through the MOVE, if you could just sort of give the listeners a sense of what's the E.
Sure. So E is where everything kind of comes together. So it's taking the mindful alertness to the three dimensions, which is what you want to achieve, the options generator, which is how you can achieve it, and then vantage point, which is like, what are the rules of reality that we have to respect? And then how do you scale it up? So for us, it's about sending leadership signals. And very briefly, we have taken and adapted military theory of leadership on how to decentralize a mission effectively so that if it's called commander's intent. So if the commander, or in our case, the leader, is not in the room or on the ground with the organization all the way out to its edge can still take decisions in alignment with the mission and also act in a way that is consistent with the values and the culture of the organization. So that basically is talking about sending leadership signals of, for M, what do we need to do? It's where are we going? Why are we going there? And what are the steps along the way to know that we're winning? Because you can set a big inspiring goal, for example, which can overwhelm people. So they need something to really ground them in terms of what's the next best step. So that's kind of the M part of leader's intent. Then for O, you know, as a big leader, I'm not going to be prescriptive to my people about how they need to go forward with things. There's many ways to a win, which we want. But I might be prescriptive about the big guidelines, the guardrails of what we can play in. So for example, I might say, hey, for 2023 or 2024, inorganic growth is off the table. It has to be organic growth. But within that, knock yourself out. It can be a change in business model, pricing strategies, channels, products, geographies, you know, whatever you want. So do that. And then the V is, what is our vantage point? So the vantage point is, how much time have we got to do this mission? What are our financial constraints? And, oh, by the way, how do we have to behave while we're doing this in terms of the rules of engagement and the values that we live and the way we relate to each other? So that together is sending a leadership signal. You do that, you kind of put a stake in the ground with that direction. And then as you learn new stuff, because you want to hear back from your organization, and this is often co-created with your team, but you still want to hear back from the organization about, hey, I think you're wrong on this, or I think you missed this, or why don't we adjust this? And you're also learning from the external environment. So all the way along, as you continue to learn, you refine your leader's intent and update it based on the things that you learn over time.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. David speaks about borrowing from the military theory of leadership. In this podcast, I had an opportunity to speak to a former Army officer, Captain Raghu Raman, who spoke about an interesting framework that can be helpful in transmitting intent down the chain. He calls it Zed Kit Bag, Zkitbag.
So how to assume orders in the absence of orders? That is the fundamental reason for a framework like this. So it's a very simple framework, and its origin lies in the orders and the briefing of the Indian Armed Forces. And as you probably are aware, the Indian Armed Forces heritage is largely from the erstwhile British Indian Army. So the use of the lingo is peppered with Urdu and erstwhile Hindustani. So it's not, and of course some elements of English, because the orders were, you know, sort of British officers and Hindi-speaking, Urdu-speaking troops.
Sure.
So Z, of course, stands for Zamini Nishan. A loose translation of that in the civilian street would be environmental scan. So before you're beginning an operation, you got to give the troops an orientation. You're fighting in a desert. What does that mean? How does it, you know, when the daytime temperatures goes up to this much, nighttime it plummets to this much. These are the sort of canals which describe our boundary. So if you cross this canal, it means basically you've gone past your target. You know, so you are orienting them to the environmental scan, and that has an application in the civil street as well. If you say you're trying to decide a strategy for, say, the pharma sector, then your environmental scan will talk about what are the regulations in that space, who are the regulators, what are the boundary conditions,
what are the patent laws.
Yep. You need to understand all of that kind of stuff. The kit bag as an acronym is also chosen so the soldiers remember. A kit bag is simple to remember. You'll never forget kit bag. And Z, of course, if you just prefix it, you'll remember Z kit bag. K stands for khabar. Khabar is information. So, and information is always, it starts with your competitor's information first. So you'll always, you know, brief your team on the org structure of the enemy, the enemy commanders, what is their, what are their strong points, what are their weak points, which areas are the ones, which are their hot buttons. So, You could mess with some of your, say, competitors in all over India. But if you mess with them in their hometown, the response will be disproportionately hard. Okay. So understanding your competitor's khabar, information, and then it's followed by your own khabar. Who are you? What is your strength? What are your sister organizations? What are the boundary conditions between the sister organizations? So that two of the sister organizations are not pitching for the same account. So you understand whom can you call for support in case you require assistance in, you know, say digital some stuff, then there is an arm of ours which can provide us with that support. So it's khabar apni. Sure. I stands for irada. What is the strategic intent? What are you trying to achieve out of this entire exercise? So it's not just the transactional steps. It is what is the overall intent of the commander? How that intent is sort of checked back. So you actually give out an irada and then you check back with your troops that repeat the strategic intent so that verbatim they are able to repeat that. It becomes ingrained in every person as a North Star that this is the strategic intent of my commander, not the interim steps. Those are only ways to achieve the strategic intent. T in kit bag, T stands for tariqa. Tariqa is methodology. How are you going to achieve this strategic intent? What are the various phases in which you will do that? How will you hand over from one phase to the next phase? Who will be the phase two commander? What will be the sign that phase one has ended and phase two has begun? What will be the milestones and how will you communicate with various different teams? If there is overlap, who will be responsible for the overlap? And the tariqa goes into those details. Bandobast is resourcing troops to task, as we call it. Yeah. That to achieve this objective, how many troops to task do you need? Do you have sufficient troops? Is there a backup? If the first piece does not work, do you have enough resilience in, say, your cash flow to take care of, say, 6 months of your sales plan not, you know, actually fructifying?
Resources.
It's true, like what we call troops to task, which means for this task, how much of troops do you need? What are the resources? Yeah, so resourcing. A stands for administration. So, I mean, again, many companies fail because they don't look at that part. They do the hiring, but they haven't got the laptop piece in place. So they don't have the seating because that's in a dissonance. So you suddenly have 40 employees you have given appointment letters to, but you have seating space for only 13. Yeah. And so 22 of them are supposedly working from home or not working at all or are drawing pay and, you know, waiting for. So administration basically talks about all the administrative requirements which need to be done. And G stands for, I think, one of the most important aspects which is ignored, unfortunately, several times in organizations, and that is ghadi milao. And what that implies is, if I am a infantry commander who's going to launch an attack at my target, and let's say I'm going to launch the attack at first light, which is at 6 o'clock in the morning, and before I launch my attack, I want that complete area to be softened, as we say, by artillery fire. And I want the firing to start from 5:50 to 6 o'clock. 10 minutes, I want intense firing on that target. And as soon as the firing lifts, when the troops there are badly, you know, sort of damaged or dazed, then I launch the attack. Now, you can imagine what could go wrong if my watch and my artillery commander's watch is just off by 1 minute. That 1 minute, I will launch the attack and they will be firing, still firing. So it's extremely important to synchronize our timelines. Timelining, I think, is an extremely important but often ignored, especially when you're looking at large enterprises which have many moving parts. So once again, Z, Zamini Nishan, K, Khabar, I, Irada, T, Tariqa, B, Bandobast, A, Administration, G, Ghadi Milao.
Back to what Carol and David say, while it's critical to ensure that we give the teams the autonomy to thrive, it's important that we set the broad guardrails which can help them make good choices as they move forward. Let's get back to Carol and David and hear them talk about the application of their framework in the context of coaching.
And as I was understanding the MOVE framework, I was curious about how it applies in the life of coaches, right? I guess at some level, you know, while, you know, the primary audience for the framework I discovered was the leaders that we coach. But I guess as I was reflecting on it, as I found it as relevant or even more relevant in the way I could apply it as a coach. I'd love to hear from the two of you on how you sort of, you know, sort of bring MOVE to bear in the coaching work that the two of you do.
I would say it's always with me. First, so let's say Deepak, you know, you're my coaching client, and the very first thing I'll want to do is I'll go immediately to, in my mind, the second and third dimensions of change to start. Like, I'm first going to want to create a safe relationship with you and like you and really try to be who I really am, not trying to impress you. So I'm using that as my self-regulation to start. And then we might sort of think about, okay, what is it we really need to do? You know, so let's start getting the objectives. Now, then I pass that on to you. Like, what do you need to do? Who do you need to be? How do you want to relate? But I'm using that with myself first. Okay, so then one, and there's a whole story about this in the book, is as I'm working with you, I'm going to be noticing your stances and my stances. I give an example of working with a leader who's having a lot of trouble with his boss, and he's really into it and he's leaning in. And the next thing I know is I've caught that leaning in energy and I'm leaning into, and we're thinking about how is he going to manage this situation. And then all of a sudden I go, oops, lean back, Carol, lean back. Let's back up and then ask, well, let's look at the overview and the context, what might be going on. And then all of a sudden there's a bigger view. And then in that case, it may also be, you know, if you put the well-being of your boss there right in the front and center, how would that relate to what, you know, you might do, you know, as the coachee and their boss, but then for myself as well. And then the other big one is, you know, say you're talking to me as your client and I'm thinking I know what to say. It's like, well, how can I sort of not lean and give you space? So all of a sudden you stop talking. I need to be okay with that and be able to not lean. And then, of course, with vantage point, you know, as I'm listening, I'm not going to believe my first set of thoughts, but I'm also going to be noticing where are you, you know? And I might say, hey, you know, Deepak, are you connecting the dots with your hopes or your fears here? What's your sense of how clear you are? I won't necessarily be the one that says, gee, you're not clear, but I can say to you, how clear are you? And, you know, if that's low or whatever, and then engage and affect change. I think, again, what are the leadership signals, you know, as a coach? What am I sending out? What am I noticing about what you're sending out? So I think these are ways to be making space for yourself and the person you're coaching in parallel, basically all the time.
Well, I think for me, a lot of this lives in the options generator for me, because when you think of a lot of coaches, there are a lot of one-trick ponies out there that would go like, Deepak, this is all about your energy, or Deepak, it's all about mindfulness, or it's all about strengths-based positive psychology. And we're like, yes, and a whole bunch of other things. So for us, when you're trying to help someone move from like the highest peak that they're at right now to the biggest peak in the planet, whether it's in the Alps or whatever, it's very unclear about how to get there. And so we want to try a whole bunch of stuff. So we want to create many, 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 many options that we can draw on in our coaching. So the idea is that you try something which is based on our hypothesis that we think this might serve our client. And if it does, and if they get a little bit more elevation, like heading towards the Alps on that, then we keep going. And if they don't, or it doesn't resonate with them, or they just say, I just don't want to do this, then we try something else. So for us, it's like it's creating many, many, many different options so that we can best be in service of our clients.
And in a way, I'm guessing that's linked to the two-on-one coaching model, right? When I read the book, what I found intriguing was the fact that the two of you very often work as a pair with coaches. And I'm sure one of the many benefits that the clients get is just the option generation, which is that much richer, given the breadth of your experiences and the diversity of vantage points.
Yeah, I mean, you can tell just from the conversation that we're very different people in terms of our personalities, the experiences that we bring, and the tools that we've got. But it's interesting that we're extremely complementary in terms of how we come to most often the same conclusions from very different angles, which really helps to validate things. And also what we find is that, you know, each of us are, we think, pretty good coaches, at least that's what the world tells us. But you can always miss something in a one-on-one situation. But just given the nature of the two of us, it's if I miss something in a conversation, Carol's almost certain to pick up on it. And if Carol misses something, I'm almost certain to pick up on that. So that combination together actually makes us to be much more powerfully in service of leaders who are facing the most complex sort of behavioral and commercial challenges.
So David and Carol, it's been a wonderful conversation. This podcast is titled Play to Potential. One question I ask all the guests is what the term means to them. So what does the term playing to potential mean to the two of you?
Being at my best on every single one of the MOVE subcategories. That's what it would mean to me.
Mm-hmm. And I think for me, it's to be extraordinary. It means being a real-time leader all the time. So that's like a goal that is almost impossible to achieve, but that's something that coherence with being a real time all the time is something that I would aspire to, and that would be playing to potential.
Lovely.
That's right. And we've talked about that our true goal for people is, yes, it's great to be super successful, et cetera, but it's really to become a really good human and even to become an extraordinary person. And help leave the world in a better place than we found it, and to help our leaders do that.
Lovely. On that note, David and Carol, thank you so much for making the time on a busy
Friday evening. Thank you, Deepak. Thanks for inviting us. This was great. We really appreciate it.
I hope you found the conversation purposeful. If you missed listening to the intro, I wanted to share an update with you here. Given that we crossed 100 guests, we wanted to pause and reflect on the library that we've accumulated till date. So as a result, we are going to stop new guests for a while. Instead, we're going to look at the themes where we connect the dots across what different guests said on a particular theme. A lot of our listeners have told us that this is what makes this podcast unique. The fact that we cross-reference insights across the various sections of the podcast. We hope you will like that as we do that for the next few months. And needless to say, once we finish connecting the dots, we'll come back to marching forward with new guests once again. Thank you for your trust, and look forward to having you tune into one of the subsequent conversations at the podcast. Bye now.